great authority, and children are expected to heed their parents' wishes above all other respects. And there is a certain warrant for this kind of respect. By the time you are a young adult, you should be willing to admit that the single relationship that has most shaped who you are, for good and ill, is your relationship to your parents. You wouldn't be alive without them, and all but a few parents have made enormous sacrifices for the well-being of their children. And yet right in the midst of these patriarchal cultures, and in the face of these realities, God says, I didn't put a parent and a child in the garden. I put a husband and a wife. When you marry your spouse, that must supersede all other relationships, even the parental relationship. Your spouse and your marriage must be the number one priority in your life. Your marriage must be more important to you than anything else. No other human being should get more of your love, energy, industry, and commitment than your spouse. God asks that a man leave his father and mother, as powerful as that relationship may have been, to forge a new union that must be an even more important and powerful force in his life. Pseudo-spouses. When I was a young pastor in a small southern town, I did a lot of marriage counseling. Some marriages were harmed by things like drink, drugs, pornography, or an extramarital affair. But in most of the troubled marriages I saw, the problem stemmed not from bad things, but from very good things that had become too important. When some good thing becomes more engrossing and important than your spouse, it can destroy the marriage. There are many varieties. Sometimes I heard a wife say, "His parents' opinions are more important to him than mine. Pleasing them is far more important to him than pleasing me." Or I would hear a husband say, "She's totally wrapped up in the kids, in their needs, programs, school, social life. If I need something, she shrugs and says, 'Okay.' But it's the kids and their needs that really excite her. Being a mother is much more enjoyable to her than being a wife." I could also hear either husband or wife say about the other, "His or her career is what's really important. The career is the real spouse. The career gets all the ingenuity and time and energy." If your spouse does not feel that you are putting him or her first, then by definition you aren't. And when that happens, your marriage is dying. Plenty of people have marital problems because they haven't left to cleave to their spouses. You have failed to leave your parents if you are more driven by their wishes and expectations than by your spouses. But you can also fail to leave your parents if you resent or hate them too much. For example, you may say, "I won't bring my kids to church because my parents did that, and I hated it." But this means you are being controlled by your parents. You aren't making the choice based on what your children need, but based on repudiating your parents. Or you may say, "I can't marry him. He reminds me of my father." So what if a man resembles your father? You should be judging him on what he is in toto and how he relates to you. Don't let your bad relationship with your father control how you relate to your partner. You must leave it behind. Some spouses have constant arguments over a variety of practical issues, from how decisions are made to how vacations are taken to how children are disciplined. Look carefully to see whether you are insisting that you do things exactly the way your parents did them. Maybe your family's way of operating was wise in a particular regard, but you should only carry it into your new family if it makes sense to your spouse, too. You shouldn't do it simply because my family did it that way. When you marry, you commit to becoming a new decision-making unit and to developing new patterns and ways of doing things. If you rigidly impose the patterns that you saw in your own family, rather than working together with your spouse to create new ones that fit both of you, you haven't left home yet. Overcommitment to parents is one problem that sinks many marriages. Arguably, overcommitment to children is even more of a problem. There are a lot of reasons why this is a major temptation today. First, your children do need you desperately. They are part of your new family, not your former family, so it is right to consider parenting a very high and important calling in life. Also, if a marriage cools, it is natural to get your primary need for love and affection met through the parent-child relationship, rather than the husband-wife relationship. But if you love your children more than your spouse, the entire family will be pulled out of joint and everyone will suffer. And I do mean everyone. I know of a woman who was giving her life for her daughter, but in such a way that it was creating great stress and strain between her and her husband. The husband resented the time and effort the mother was putting into their daughter's musical career. It was clear to nearly everyone that the mother was fulfilling some of her own unrealized dreams through her daughter, but in the process she was killing her marriage. The irony was, this was the worst possible thing for her daughter, who was very anxious about the crumbling marriage. A strong marriage between parents makes children grow up feeling the world is a safe place, and love is possible. Also, her daughter was not learning from observation how a good marriage worked, or how men and women can relate together well. By putting her daughter before her husband, she was harming her daughter. A breakthrough came when a counselor said to her, "The best way for you to be a great mother to your daughter is by being a great wife to your husband. That is the main thing your daughter needs from you." When she began to see this, she began to give her marriage the priority it should have. Research on child abuse has revealed that many of the people who physically abuse their children don't do so because they hate their children. Often it is because their children are the ones on whom they rely for most of their love, and if their children don't love them back by behaving properly, their anger explodes, they snap. But children are children. They shouldn't be expected to give you the friendship and love that a spouse can. The power of marriage. Marriage is so much like salvation and our relationship with Christ that Paul says you can't understand marriage without looking at the gospel. So let's do that. Salvation is a fresh start. Old things have passed away. Behold, the new has come. And when through the gospel we enter into a marriage-like relationship with Jesus as our divine spouse, that means giving Christ the supremacy in your life. See Colossians chapter 1, verse 15. In other words, Jesus asks for nothing that any spouse doesn't ask for. "Put me first," he says. "Have no other pseudo-gods before me." It is the same with marriage. Marriage won't work unless you put your marriage and your spouse first, and you don't turn good things, like parents, children, career, and hobbies, into pseudo-spouses. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 28, Paul introduces another metaphor. He says that a husband ought to love his wife as he does his own body. Paul is referring to the fact that your health is foundational to everything else you do. What if you decide that making a lot of money will make you happy, so you put your work ahead of your health? You work enormously long hours, so that you get no exercise or sleep. You eat very poorly, and you put yourself under a lot of stress. Yes, you are making a lot of money, but the heart attack you bring on will make it impossible to enjoy your wealth. In other words, if you think you can put your happiness ahead of your health, you actually won't be happy at all. Good health, then, is more fundamental to happiness than great wealth, as most rich people will tell you when their health has broken down. Paul likens marriage to the health of your body. As we have said, it must be the most foundational human relationship of your life. When you marry, you've gotten into something that was invented by God. And if you determine to run your marriage your way, you're in for a lot of trouble. Because marriage is God's institution. He built it to be the primary relationship in your life. If you think that marriage is going to be a sidebar to your great career, that it is going to come second or third in your life, and that your spouse had better get used to it, watch out. Marriage isn't built that way. Once you've married, your marriage has to take priority. The reason it must have priority is because of the power of marriage. Marriage has the power to set the course of your life as a whole. If your marriage is strong, even if all the circumstances in your life around you are filled with trouble and weakness, it won't matter. You will be able to move out into the world in strength. However, if your marriage is weak, even if all the circumstances in your life around you are marked by success and strength, it won't matter. You will move out into the world in weakness. Marriage has that kind of power, the power to set the course of your whole life. It has that power because it was instituted by God, and because it has that unequaled power, it must have an unequaled supreme priority. And the main message of this chapter is that the key to giving marriage that kind of priority is spiritual friendship. So many marriages are begun with a journey to God only as an afterthought. Many Christians congratulate themselves that they have married another believer, but they look at their prospective spouse's faith as simply one more factor that makes him or her compatible, like common interests and hobbies. But that is not what spiritual friendship is. It is eagerly helping one another know, serve, love, and resemble God in deeper and deeper ways. A parishioner heard me preach on Ephesians chapter 5, where Paul says that the purpose of marriage is to sanctify us. She said, "I thought the whole point of marriage was to be happy. You make it sound like a lot of work." She was right. Marriage is a lot of work. But she was wrong to pit that against happiness, and here is why. Paul is saying that one of the main purposes of marriage is to make us holy, without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish. See verses 26 and 27. What does that mean? It means to have Jesus' character reproduced in us, outlined as the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithful integrity, gentle humility, and self-control. In Galatians chapter 5, verses 22 through 25. When Jesus' love, wisdom, and greatness are formed in us, each with our own unique gifts and callings, we become our true selves, the persons we were created to be. Every page in the Bible cries that the journey to this horizon cannot be accomplished alone. We must face it and share it with brothers and sisters, friends of our heart. And the very best human friendship possible for that adventure is with the lover friend who is your spouse. Is all this a lot of work? Indeed it is. But it is the work we were built to do. Does this mean marriage is not about being happy? It's about being holy? Yes and no. As we have seen, that is too stark a contrast. If you understand what holiness is, you come to see that real happiness is on the far side of holiness, not the near side. Holiness gives us new desires and brings old desires into line with one another. So if we want to be happy in marriage, we will accept that marriage is designed to make us holy. As C.S. Lewis writes, "He gives the happiness that there is, not the happiness that is not. To be God, to be like God and to share His goodness in creaturely response, to be miserable, these are the only three alternatives. If we will not learn to eat the only food that the universe grows, the only food that any possible universe can ever grow, then we must starve eternally." Now, we are ready to get specific. How exactly can spouses help one another on this journey to God? The answers will come in the next chapter. Chapter 5. Loving the Stranger. "And gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word." Ephesians chapter 5, verses 25 and 26. Let's recall the point made by Stanley Hauerwas. We never know whom we marry. We just think we do. Or even if we first marry the right person, just give it a while, and he or she will change. For marriage, being the enormous thing it is, means we are not the same person after we have entered it. The primary problem is learning how to love and care for the stranger to whom you find yourself married. Auerbach's realism rings true to people who have been married for a long time. Marriage changes us. Having children changes us. A career switch changes us. Age changes us. On top of everything else, marriage brings out and reveals traits in you that were there all along, but were hidden from everyone, including you. But now, they are all seen by your spouse. Most people enter marriage through the in-love experience, and at its peak, it is euphoric. Two people can become almost obsessed with each other. Marriage counselor and author Gary Chapman argues that the in-love phase, which he believes usually lasts several months to 2 years, includes the illusion that the beloved is perfect in every aspect that matters. Describing one of his counselees, Jen, he writes, "Her best friend could see the flaws in her fiancé. It bothers her how he talks to Jen sometimes, but Jen won't listen. Her mother, noting the young man seems unable to hold a steady job, keeps her concerns to herself, but asks polite questions about Ryan's plans." Chapman goes on to describe the condition. "Of course, we are not totally naive. We know intellectually that we will eventually have differences, but we are certain that we will quickly reach agreement. We are caught up in the beauty and charm of the other's personality. Our love is the most wonderful thing we have ever experienced. We observe that some married couples seem to have lost that feeling, but it will never happen to us. Maybe they didn't have the real thing, we reason." The in-love experience passes when the flaws in the other person come home to us. Things that seem small and inconsequential now loom large. We begin to feel that we did not really know the person after all. And this presents us with the challenge of loving a person who, at the moment, seems in large part a stranger, not the person you remember marrying. When this happens, people respond in a number of different ways. If your purpose in marriage was to acquire a soulmate, a person who would not change you and would supportively help you reach your life goals, then this particular reality of marriage will be deeply disorienting. You wake up to the realization that your marriage will take a huge investment of time just to make it work. Just as distressing will be the discovery that your spouse finds you a stranger and has begun to confront you with a list of your serious shortcomings. Your first response will be to tell yourself you made a bad choice and failed to find someone truly compatible. What if, however, you began your marriage understanding its purpose as spiritual friendship for the journey to the new creation? What if you expected marriage to be about helping each other grow out of your sins and flaws into the new self God has created? Then you will actually be expecting the stranger seasons. And when you come to one, you will roll up your sleeves and get to work. What are the tools for this work? How can we engage one another in spiritual friendship to help us on our journey toward our future selves? How do we love each other so that our marriage goes on from strength to strength rather than stalling out in repetitive arguments that end in fruitless silence? The basic answer is that you must speak the truth in love with the power of God's grace. Speaking the truth in love, we will in all things grow up into Him who is the head, that is, Christ. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 15. And that statement sounds platitudinous until we break it down. As a divine institution, marriage has several inherent powers that we must accept and use: the power of truth, the power of love, and the power of grace. As we use each power in the life of our spouse, we will help him or her grow into a person who not only reflects the character of Christ, but who also can love us and help us in the same way. These three powers will do their best work in us during times when we find it hard to love the semi-stranger to whom we are married. The power of truth, facing the worst. There's a passage in Soren Kierkegaard's work where he likens all of us to people at a costume ball. Do you not know that there comes a midnight hour when everyone has to throw off his mask? At the time, the custom was to keep your mask on for the first part of festivities. During that time, you danced, ate, and talked with other guests, but no one knew who anyone else was. But then at midnight, all masks had to be stripped off and everyone's true identity was revealed. In some ways, the Cinderella story is an extension of this theme. That an hour comes in which all the layers of glitter are taken away, and the real, unvarnished you stands there, unfiltered, for all to see. That sounds like Judgment Day, doesn't it? But it also sounds like marriage. In marriage, you can't hide. You are exposed. You finally have your mask and finery stripped away, as it were. How so? Marriage brings two human beings into closer contact than any other relationship can bring them. The parent-child relationship is, of course, very close. They live together and see one another's character. But there is a major power differential there. The child and the parents are on such different planes that it is easy for either the parent to dismiss the child's criticism or the child to dismiss the parents. Besides, it is expected that children grow up and leave. Marriage is also a more inescapable relationship than cohabitation. When unmarried people live together, they certainly see one another up close, but each party knows that the other one does not have the same claims on him or her that would be true if they were married. They don't merge their entire lives, socially, economically, legally, and so either one can walk away, with relatively few complications if they don't like what they are being told. Marriage is different from these others. The merged life of marriage brings you into the closest, most inescapable contact with another person possible. And that means not only that you see each other close up, but that you are forced to deal with the flaws and sins of one another. What are the flaws that your spouse will see? You may be a fearful person with a tendency toward great anxiety. You may be a proud person with a tendency to be opinionated and selfish. You may be an inflexible person with a tendency to be demanding and sulky if you don't get your way. You may be an abrasive or harsh person who people tend to respect more than they love. You may be an undisciplined person with a tendency to be unreliable and disorganized. You may be an oblivious person who tends to be distracted, insensitive, and unaware of how you come across to others. You may be a perfectionist with a tendency to be judgmental and critical of others, and also to get down on yourself. You may be an impatient, irritable person with a tendency to hold grudges or to lose your temper too often. You may be a highly independent person who does not like to be responsible for the needs of others, who dislikes having to make joint decisions, and who most definitely hates to ask for any help yourself. You may be a person who wants far too much to be liked, and so you tend to shade the truth. You can't keep secrets, and you work too hard to please everyone. You may be thrifty, but at the same time miserly with money, too unwilling to spend it on your own needs appropriately, and ungenerous to others. Others have seen these flaws in you. Your parents certainly have, and others that have lived with you, such as siblings or college roommates or friends, have seen them too. But if they spoke to you about them, you could either write them off as being biased or mistaken, or you could escape from the weight of the criticism by vaguely promising to do better in the future. However, your confronters didn't keep up their confrontations, and you haven't really admitted the severity of the problem. The reason was that the flaw did not pose the same kind of problem for them as it will for your spouse. But while your character flaws may have created mild problems for other people, they will create major problems for your spouse and your marriage. For example, a tendency to hold grudges could become a problem within friendships, but within marriage, It can kill the relationship. No one else is as inconvenienced and hurt by your flaws as your spouse is. And therefore your spouse becomes more keenly aware of what is wrong with you than anyone else ever has been. When conducting marriage services, I like to explain this aspect of marriage using the analogy of a bridge. Think of an old bridge over a stream. Imagine that there are structural defects in the bridge that are hard to see. There may be hairline fractures that a very close inspection would reveal, but to the naked eye there is nothing wrong. But now see a 10-ton Mack truck drive onto the bridge. What will happen? The pressure from the weight of the truck will open those hairline fractures so they can be seen. The structural defects will be exposed for all to see because of the strain the truck puts on the bridge. Suddenly you can see where all the flaws are. The truck didn't create the weaknesses. It revealed them. When you get married, your spouse is a big truck driving right through your heart. Marriage brings out the worst in you. It doesn't create your weaknesses, though you may blame your spouse for your blow-ups. It reveals them. This is not a bad thing, though. How can you change into your glory self if you assume that you're already pretty close to perfect as it is? When I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer in 2002, it was during a routine checkup. My doctor just happened to feel a tiny lump in my neck. Though the surgery and subsequent treatments were painful and frightening, at no time did the thought ever cross my mind, "Oh, I wish the doctor had never found that lump. It was so small, why couldn't he just have missed it and spared me all this trouble?" That was because the consequences of being spared all the trouble would have been, in the end, far more deadly, far more trouble than finding and treating the cancer while it was small and confined. The first part of making your marriage into a relationship that enhances growth is to accept this inherent feature of married life. Marriage, by its very nature, has the power of truth, the power to show you the truth about who you are. People are appalled when they get sharp, far-reaching criticisms from their spouses. They immediately begin to think they married the wrong person. But you must realize that it isn't ultimately your spouse who is exposing the sinfulness of your heart. It's marriage itself. Marriage does not so much bring you into confrontation with your spouse as confront you with yourself. Marriage shows you a realistic, unflattering picture of who you are, and then takes you by the scruff of the neck and forces you to pay attention to it. This may sound discouraging, but it is really the road to liberation. Counselors will tell you that the only flaws that can enslave you are the ones that you are blind to. If you are in denial about some feature of your character, that feature will control you. But marriage blows the lid off, turns the lights on. Now, there is hope. Finally, you can begin dealing with the real you. Don't resist this power that marriage has. Give your spouse the right to talk to you about what is wrong with you. Paul talks about how Jesus washes and cleanses us of stains and blemishes. Give your spouse the right to do that. All his life, Rob had few friends. One reason for this was that since childhood, Rob had a real problem putting himself into the shoes of others. He had little or no empathy and often was surprised at people's negative reactions to his words or deeds. When he was in fourth grade, a school counselor told his parents that he thought Rob was a mild sociopath, someone who often trampled on the feelings of others because he couldn't sympathetically imagine what they were feeling. This character flaw had created problems for Rob for years, but he couldn't see it for what it was. Few of his acquaintances ripened into friendships, and in his first jobs he regularly made missteps that infuriated both superiors and those reporting to him. He lost one job over it. Then he met Jessica, and by the second date they both were deep into the in-love experience. She thought he was a brilliant conversationalist, and he was, and he loved the fact that she was an assertive kind of woman who didn't easily get her feelings hurt. Several times his sense of humor strayed into the realm of the hurtful and the insulting. This was a problem that he had had all his life, but unlike so many others, Jessica just told him off and put him in his place. He liked that. Finally, a woman who wasn't a shrinking violet. And so, they married. But as the months went by, Rob's insensitive humor and semi-abusive remarks got worse. When we are in love, we are on our best behavior. But at home, and with someone becoming more and more familiar, our natural instincts take over. We no longer catch ourselves. Soon the full extent of Rob's problem character was there for Jessica to see, in all its ugly detail. Jessica began to see how he spoke to other people, and most of them were not as resilient and thick-skinned as she was. She realized the kind of relational problems that he was going to have all his life. She became deeply disillusioned with him. And just a year after their wedding, she found herself fantasizing about being single again and free from him. When Rob realized the depth of her unhappiness, he became alarmed, and together they sought counseling from the pastor of their church. That began a long journey. After many weeks of meetings with their pastoral counselor, they had their first breakthrough. One evening, both Rob and Jessica began to see that she had been brought into Rob's life for this very purpose. She was a strong woman who was not fragile. She was exactly the person who could stand toe-to-toe with Rob and say, "That hurt me. I'm going to tell you exactly how it felt until you learn what your words do to people. I'm not going to clam up on you and just withdraw, and I'm not going to attack you back. I'm going to be like Jesus has been with us, accepting us in love but not allowing us to just destroy ourselves with sin." Rob had never had anyone love him like this. People had either just given up and withdrawn from him or had simply attacked him. Here was someone who, calmly but candidly, described the devastating effect of his words. And most transforming of all was the fact that the person who was telling him about his hurtfulness was the person he loved most in the world. The more Jessica loved him so nobly and well, the less he wanted to see her hurt. And so, slowly but surely, Rob began to listen, learn, and change. Jessica herself came to see that she also had a need for radical change. "I had a fiercely independent spirit that made it hard for me to depend on anyone," she said. "If anyone let me down, I simply dropped them. I was completely impatient with them." When she saw the depths of Rob's problems, she wanted to flee, as she always had. But her marriage vow wouldn't allow her to do that. For the first time in her life, she couldn't run from a damaged person. 3 years after their wedding, Rob's parents hardly recognized him. He was more thoughtful and empathetic than they ever thought he could be. Jessica's parents noticed a gentleness and a graciousness toward weakness that they hadn't seen in her before. Marriage's power of truth had done its work. Someone better is your spouse. We see then that the power of truth that comes with marriage is a gift, but it truly is a hard gift to receive. When you are seeing some new flaws in your spouse, or if you are always being told what is wrong with you, it takes a toll on the feelings. We are like ore, right out of the mine. When you got married, you saw the gold in your spouse, but as time goes on, you see all the impurities. You see attitudes and personality traits and sinful habits that are going to be burned off as dross in the light of God's glory over time. These flaws are not permanent, but they can loom large in your mind and create big problems, and that is hard to take. And yet if two people learn to make the distinction between the dross and the gold, it can be a great help. Instead of saying, "That's just the way he is and I hate it," remember that the part of him you hate isn't the real, permanent him. In Romans chapter 7, verses 14 through 25, Paul speaks about this dynamic in himself. "I do the very things I hate. chapter 7, verse 15. And therefore, it's not really me doing it, it's the sin living within me, chapter 7, verse 20. This does not mean that Paul doesn't take full responsibility for his actions, but he knows that the sinful actions are not from his innermost being, where he delights in the law of God, chapter 7, verse 22. Christian spouses must make the same distinction. It will help a great deal to say, I hate it when he does that, but that is not truly him. That is not permanent. It will help even more to work together to agree on what is the dross and what is the gold in each other, so you can say, this is the real you. This is the real me. This is what God wants us to be, and this is what has got to go. And we've got to work together against it. I won't minimize the disappointment of seeing the dross. When people first begin to see the flaws in their spouses, some flee the marriage. Others just withdraw, downscaling their expectations of happiness almost completely, and just learn to get along. Others go into a long period of fighting and blaming their spouses for their unhappiness. All of these approaches share one thing in common, however. One spouse looks at his or her spouse's weaknesses and says, I need to find someone better than this. But the great thing about the model of Christian marriage we are presenting here is that when you envision the someone better, you can think of the future version of the person to whom you are already married. The someone better is the spouse you already have. God has indeed given us a desire for the perfect spouse, but you should seek it in the one to whom you're married. Why discard this partner for someone else only to discover that person's deep hidden flaws? Some people with serial marriages go through the cycle of infatuation, disillusionment, rejection, and flight to someone else, over and over. The only way you're going to actually begin to see another person's glory self is to stick with him or her. Many people have asked me, how can you tell whether you've got a friendship on which you can base a marriage? The answer that Kathy and I have always given is this. When you see the problems in each other, do you just want to run away, or do you find a desire to work on them together? If the second impulse is yours, then you have the makings of a marriage. Do you obsess over your partner's external shortcomings, or can you see the beauty within, and do you want to see it increasingly released? Then move forward. The power of truth that marriage has should hold no fear for you. The Godly Tantrum. Before we move on from the power of truth to that of love, let me encourage listeners not to shrink from really telling the truth to one another. Kathy talks of what she calls the godly tantrum. By this, she means not an emotional loss of temper, but an unrelenting insistence on being heard. When my family moved to New York City to start Redeemer Presbyterian Church, we knew that it would be very time-consuming, especially given my tendency to overwork. From what I learned from other church planters, my life would be out of balance for about 3 years. That is, I'd be working longer hours than I could sustain permanently without endangering my health or my family relationships. So, I asked Kathy to grant me these long hours for 3 years. After that, I promised, things would change. I'd cut back. Okay? Okay, she said. But the 3-year mark came and went, and Kathy asked me, as we agreed, to cut back on my work hours. Just a couple more months, I said. I have this and that commitment that I have to see through. Just a couple of more months. I kept saying that. The months flew by with no change. One day I came home from work. It was a nice day outside, and I noticed that the door to our apartment's balcony was open. Just as I was taking off my jacket, I heard a smashing noise coming from the balcony. In another couple of seconds, I heard another one. I walked out onto the balcony and to my surprise saw Kathy sitting on the floor. She had a hammer, and next to her was a stack of our wedding china. On the ground were the shards of 2 smashed saucers. "What are you doing?" I asked. She looked up and said, "You aren't listening to me. You don't realize that if you keep working these hours, you are going to destroy this family. I don't know how to get through to you. You aren't seeing how serious this is. This is what you are doing." And she brought the hammer down on the 3rd saucer. It splintered into pieces. I sat down trembling. I thought she had snapped. I'm listening, I said. As we talked, it became clear that she was intense and laser-focused, but she was not in a rage or out of control emotionally. She spoke calmly but forcefully. Her arguments were the same as they had been for months, but I realized how deluded I had been. There would never be a convenient time to cut back. I was addicted to the level of productivity I had achieved. I had to do something. She saw me listening for the first time, and we hugged. Finally, I inquired, "When I first came out here, I thought you were having an emotional meltdown. How did you get control of yourself so fast?" With a grin, she answered, "It was no meltdown. Do you see these 3 saucers I smashed?" I nodded. "I have no cups for them. The cups have broken over the years. I had 3 saucers to spare. I'm glad you sat down before I had to break any more." Give each other the right to hold one another accountable. Exhort one another daily, lest you become hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Hebrews chapter 3, verse 13. The power of love, renewing the heart. Marriage has the power of truth, the ability to reveal to you who you really are with all your flaws. How wonderful that it also has the power of love, an unmatched power to affirm you and heal you of the deepest wounds and hurts of your life. You come into marriage with a self-image, an assessment of your worth. It is a sign of many verdicts passed upon you over the years by a great variety of people. Parents, siblings, boyfriends and girlfriends, teachers and coaches have all passed judgments on you, called you good and bad, worthy and unworthy, promising and hopeless. We have sifted through them and tried to forget some, but that is hard. Statements of affirmation make a far lighter and less lasting impression upon the human heart than criticisms and condemnations. We may have been wounded by things that have been said to us. They have left an indelible impression. So there are many layers to this self-image, and many of them are contradictory. Your self-view has been stitched together often without a unifying theme. If it were made visible, it might look something like the Frankenstein monster, with many disparate parts. However, perhaps the most damaging statements that have ever been said about us are those things we have said about ourselves to ourselves. Many people have a never-ending loop of self-talk that berates them for being foolish, stupid, a failure, a loser. But now into your life comes someone who has the power to overturn all the accumulated verdicts that have ever been passed upon you by others or by you yourself. Marriage puts into your spouse's hand a massive power to reprogram your own self-appreciation. He or she can overturn anything previously said about you, to a great degree redeeming the past. The love and affirmation of your spouse has the power to heal you of many of the deepest wounds. Why? If all the world says you are ugly, but your spouse says you are beautiful, you feel beautiful. To paraphrase a passage of Scripture, your heart may condemn you, but your spouse's opinion is greater than your heart. In my own life, I must confess that I have never felt manly until I got married. I was a nerd before it was fashionable, playing trumpet in the marching band and staying in the Boy Scouts through high school. Good things, no doubt, but not cool or macho. I was often mocked and excluded, especially during high school, for my uncoolness. But Kathy looked at me like her knight in shining armor. She has always told me, and continues to tell me, that though all the world may look at me and see Clark Kent, she knows that underneath I have on blue underwear. She has always been very quick to point out and celebrate anything I have done that is courageous. Over the years, bit by bit, it has sunk in. To my wife, I'm Superman, and it makes me feel like a man in a way nothing else could. The same aspect of marriage that entails the power of truth also contributes to this power of love. That is, because marriage merges two lives and brings you into the closest possible contact, a positive assessment by your spouse has ultimate credibility. If someone I know a little comes up to me and says, "You are one of the kindest men I know," I will certainly feel complimented and pleased, but how deeply will it sink in? Not too far. Why? Because a part of my heart says, "Well, nice, but he doesn't really know me at all." But if my wife, after years of living with me, says, "You are one of the kindest men I know," that goes in. That affirmation is profoundly comforting. Why? Because she knows me better than anyone. And if over the years you have grown to love and admire your spouse more and more, then his or her praise will get more and more strengthening and healing. As Faramir says to Sam Gamgee in The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, "The praise of the praiseworthy is above all rewards." To be highly esteemed by someone you highly esteem is the greatest thing in the world. This principle explains why, ultimately, to know that the Lord of the universe loves you is the strongest foundation that any human being can have. A growing awareness of God's love in Christ is the greatest reward. And yet we must not forget Adam in the garden. Though he had a perfect relationship with God, his humanity's relational nature was designed also for human love. Your spouse's love for you and Christ's love work together in your life with powerful interaction. The power of healing love in marriage is a miniature version of the same power that Jesus has with us. In Christ, God sees us as righteous, holy, and beautiful. See 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21. The world tells us about our faults, and we know they are there. But God's love for us covers our sins and continues despite them. So Jesus has the ability to overcome everything anyone has ever said about or to you. In a Christian marriage, you're living that out in miniature. Sometimes your spouse points you directly to Jesus' love. Sometimes your spouse's affirmation imitates Jesus' love and stimulates us to more fully believe and accept the love we have in Christ. So, more than any other human relationship, marriage has a unique power to heal all hurts and convince us of our own distinctive beauty and worth. Love me. No, you love me. How do you give this life-healing love to your spouse so he or she actually feels loved? That is a very crucial subject and skill. Let me start with an illustration before I begin to lay out the principles. In Kathy's family, her father regularly helped her mother with the chores. He was very involved in the day-to-day domestic operations, including the care and feeding of the children. In my family, however, my father was never asked to do much in the way of chores inside the home, and in particular, he wasn't involved in clothing or feeding the kids. When we got married, we were barely aware of these differences in our family backgrounds, even though there had been one incident that should have tipped us off. Once, when I came to visit Kathy in her home, we ate dinner in the kitchen with her family. We'd progressed beyond the dining room and fine china stage. And when the meal was over, I simply stood up and walked out of the room. My future mother-in-law was appalled. In Kathy's household, everyone helped with the cleanup. At the very least, everyone was expected to take their plates and silverware and cups and any other item on the table next to their place and bring it to the sink or refrigerator. When she saw that I never even gave this a thought, she muttered something to Kathy about my wanting people to wait on me. But in my family, my mother would have been insulted if even family members, let alone a guest, helped with the dishes. That was her job, to serve and do all those menial tasks so that others did not have to do them. This family background difference did not show itself in our marriage until the birth of our first child. I remember one day I was sitting holding David when Kathy was working in the kitchen. I noticed a funny smell and said, "Kathy, his diaper needs to be changed." And Kathy said, "Well, you know what we say around our house, don't you?"
"What?"
"Finders keepers," she laughed. This meant, "Don't look at me. I'm busy. You've got the child. You change his dirty diaper." But I found myself becoming quite angry. I felt, well, I couldn't immediately put my finger on it. It seemed like a lack of respect. This shouldn't be my job. When I resisted, then it was Kathy's turn to feel annoyed. "Hey, it's just a dirty diaper. You aren't busy, and I am," she said. We didn't resolve the issue that day because we didn't really understand what was going on. The care of the children in general, and smelly poopy diapers in particular, became a bone of contention for a good while until we began to understand the underlying dynamics operating in our hearts. Kathy's mother had had a stroke when she was only in her 40s, and her father had stepped in to do many practical household chores in a way that was atypical for our parents' generation of working fathers and stay-at-home mothers. Her mother was deeply grateful for this and admired her husband's love and humility. Kathy heard her mother say, "This is how my husband loves me. He helps me with the chores and children." In my family, however, my father was never asked to do those kinds of chores. I'm not sure he ever saw the inside of a dirty diaper. He worked extremely long hours and was often very tired. My mother was grateful for his being a good provider and felt that the only way she could make an equal contribution to the family's welfare was if she asked him to do absolutely nothing around the home. And I heard my mother say, "This is how I love your father. He works so hard. He provides for the family, so when he comes home, I don't ask him to do those things. I take care of them." This difference in our families was not merely a different domestic division of labor. This was a difference in what we could call love currency. Kathy's father was a man of few words. He was not verbally expressive. But he gave his wife love in the particular way that she needed it, and that she knew was costly to him. It was far more valuable to her than if he had bought her flowers and jewelry. She appreciated it deeply, and it made her feel loved. My father, on the other hand, who worked such long hours, could have had a wife who complained about virtually raising the children on her own. She did not, and he appreciated it deeply, and felt like a king in his castle. We had observed these patterns of love currency in our respective families, and they had become part of our unconscious assumptions. And that is why we had an abiding conflict over who changes the diapers in this family. It was perplexing to us at first. It seemed like a pretty simple issue. Why was there so much emotional heat around it? Eventually, we realized that when Kathy asked me to change our son's diaper, I heard her saying that she didn't love me, that she didn't think I worked that hard. And when I asked her to be the one to change the diapers, she heard me saying that it was woman's work, not really important. In short, Kathy was actually saying, at a semi-conscious level, "If you love me the way my father loved my mother, you would change the diaper." And I was saying in my heart, "If you love me the way my mother loved my father, you wouldn't even be asking me." Each of us heard the other one saying, "I don't love you," because each of us was failing to get love in the particular way we felt was emotionally valuable to us. What happened? We realized what was going on, and in that particular instance it was I who made the change, because I didn't want to fall into a pattern of pitting my work against involvement with my children. But the lesson was one that we never forgot. It is not enough to simply say, I love you, nor is it enough to give love to your spouse in the way to which you feel most accustomed. If you want to give a person $100, there are many ways to do so. You can give it in cash, or by check, or in gold, or in kind. You can give it in different currencies. So you ask, in which form do you want the $100? In the same way you learn to give your spouse love in the way he or she finds most emotionally valuable and powerful. That is the only way to bring the remaking and healing power of love into your spouse's life. The currencies of love. What we call love currencies are often called love languages. This metaphor is also very helpful. If we say, I love you, to someone who does not understand a word of English, then the love does not get through. We are sending it, but it is not being received. We must learn to send love in forms that the other person can comprehend. I will dare to use one more metaphor. A radio signal may be sent out on one frequency, but the radio receiver does not respond if it is tuned to another frequency. In the same way, a husband may be sending out the message, I love you, by being very sensual and romantic toward his wife, but that might not be where her love receiver is tuned. He doesn't listen sympathetically to her when she wants to talk about the things that discourage her. She desperately wants an understanding listener, but he is impatient, usually barking out some brief advice. So she tells her husband, I don't feel you love me. He retorts, but I do love you. Why the discrepancy? He is sending his love over a channel to which she is not tuned. This is why, so often, love is being sent in a marriage, but is not received. There are many different ways to express love. You can buy a present, say I love you out loud, give a compliment, be romantic and tender physically, abide by your loved one's wishes, and spend time in focused attention. That's just the beginning of the list. For centuries, thinkers have discerned forms of love. The Greeks had words to distinguish affection, storge, friendship, philos, erotic love, eros, and service, agape. There are other ways of breaking down expressions of love into categories. All forms of love are necessary, and none are to be ignored, but all of us find some forms of love to be more emotionally valuable to us. They are a currency that we find particularly precious, a language that delivers the message of love to our hearts with the most power. Some types of love are more thrilling and fulfilling to us when we receive them. Why? Sometimes a particular form of love is more valuable because some significant person in your life was particularly inept at it. Sometimes a particular form of love is more valuable because some significant person in your life was particularly adept at it. Perhaps a form of love is crucial now because of your life circumstances. At any rate, some forms of love especially delight your heart. Anyone who wants to give you love needs to know what those forms are and to express his or her love in those ways. We should do this for our spouses because God did this for us. When Moses asked to see God's glory, he was told that he couldn't see it, that it would be lethal. Yet in the Gospel of John, we read that God has come in human form, so that in Jesus we beheld his glory, glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John chapter 1, verse 14. That is amazing. God expressed his glory to us in a form we could relate to, a human form. In the Incarnation, God came to us in a manner that we could grasp. So we, too, must clothe our love in the forms to which our spouse can relate. We must communicate love in the way our spouse needs it. Here are some practical principles for doing that. First, realize you have a filter on. You tend to only hear certain kinds of love language. For example, your spouse may be working hard to provide you with material things, but you wish he were more verbal. There is a tendency to say, he doesn't love me because he is not communicating love in your most valuable language. Take off your filter and recognize the love your spouse is giving you. Theologian R.C. Sproul once told us a story about himself and his wife, Vesta, that illustrates this principle. What I really wanted for my birthday was something I wouldn't buy for myself. I was hoping for new golf clubs. Vesta, a practical person, knew I needed white shirts. So, she bought me 6 beautiful white shirts. I tried not to show my disappointment. When it came time for Vesta's birthday, however, he didn't do any better. Wanting to give her something lavish and extravagant, he bought her a fur coat, not realizing that what she really wanted was a new washer and dryer. They were both trying hard to express love to each other, but they were speaking their own languages to a person who needed to hear love in a different dialect. Consider whether some of the running conflicts you have with your spouse are not love language conflicts. That can soften your attitude and change your strategy. You could, like Kathy and I, have an intractable conflict over child care responsibilities. But it could be that the husband is thinking, as I did, if you love me like my mother loved my father, you'd not ask me to change diapers. And the wife could be thinking, as Kathy did, if you love me like my father loved my mother, you'd volunteer. Instead of thinking about the other person, he or she is so selfish, each would think, he or she is feeling particularly unloved. Learn the primary languages of your spouse